Now that Unit 3 is done, we'll spend the rest of the term studying DNA, starting with Unit 4, and the first chapter of Unit 4 is the cell cycle. The cell cycle has to do with, it has to do with more than that. The cell cycle includes cell division, which I'll talk more about when we get to the particulars of the cell cycle. But this opening slide shows you some of the important reasons why cell division exists. If you think back to what I told you long ago now about cell theory, which is cells come only from pre-existing cells, well, that happens because of cell division. New cells are created because of cell division, and these are three major reasons why that happens, or what that accomplishes. One is reproduction, as you see here. Well, keep in mind that the vast majority of organisms alive now and that have ever lived are unicellular organisms, and so they exist just as one cell, by definition. And when they reproduce, it's different from how we reproduce. They reproduce by splitting their one cell that they are into two cells, and really they cease to exist in that process, right? The original organism is no longer there. It is now replaced by two brand new unicellular organisms. So that's obviously a use of cell division. But even in us multicellular organisms, cell division is important for reproduction because you start out as a unicellular zygote, and then to get to be multicellular, of course, requires multiple rounds of cell division to create the trillions of cells that you eventually become. Growth and development is listed next, which is really two different things, but it's lumped together because they're related. Growth, of course, refers to increase in size. Well, there's two aspects to that. Even for a unicellular organism, there is growth. And it should make common sense to you when you think about it. When a unicellular organism, that cell that it is, splits into two, at that moment, of course, those two new cells are not full size. They can't be. They're roughly half of the size of the original cell when it splits. And therefore, even one cell grows a certain amount to become a full-sized cell. But in terms of growth of an organism involving cell division, that really applies to multicellular organisms. Because when we grow, we don't simply make our one cell that we start out as huge, like I've talked about before. The cell size is constrained by surface area to volume ratio, like we discussed. So we can become huge because we can add a bunch of cells to our body that are all equally small, or all small, and therefore maintain that high surface area to volume ratio. So that involves cell division. Development is related because it occurs during growth of a multicellular organism, but development refers to changes that take place along the way that cause cells to specialize. So an adult human is not 100 trillion identical cells. By the time a human develops, those 100 trillion cells are in different categories. There's all kinds of different kinds of cells that do different jobs, even though they're part of the same organism. That's what development is. And then tissue renewal, of course, applies only to multicellular organisms because only multicellular organisms have tissues. Remember that tissues is one level on that hierarchy of biological organization that we started the term with. That goes from atoms all the way up to the biosphere. Tissues is one level. Tissue is a collection of cells operating for a certain function, like an epithelium or a muscle tissue. Well, tissue renewal refers to the fact that tissues get damaged in multicellular organisms. You know, a unicellular organism loses a cell. If a cell dies, then the organism is dead because the organism is just one cell. But in us, we every day lose by cell death millions of cells, billions even. When you injure yourself, you're causing damage to tissues. And the way that multicellular organisms renew or repair those tissues is by replacing cells that have died with new copies. And those new copies, once again, don't just pop into existence. They have to come from pre-existing cells. Cells that survived the injury, basically, get spurred into creating new cells by dividing, and that leads to tissue renewal. Now, in this second slide, which is just a photograph of a cell, a photomicrograph, we're obviously looking at a cell. Hopefully it's obvious that this is a cell. But even more specifically, if you think of the dichotomy of cell types we've talked about several times, what kind of cell is this? This is a eukaryotic cell. And why do you say that? Right, it has a well-defined nucleus. You can easily see that there's a nucleus here, right? And therefore, this is a eukaryotic cell. The nucleus of a eukaryotic cell is fairly easy to spot than you did in lab when you looked at your own cheek cells, right? You could see the nucleus even under a light microscope. Kind of just looks like a dot within the cell. You didn't really see any detail in there. Here you see a little bit of detail, but this is kind of an unusual situation. What I mean here is that this cell is in a particular part of the cell cycle that is really just a small part of the cell cycle. The cell cycle, which is really the main theme of the chapter, you can think of as the entire lifetime of one cell. It's a cycle because it goes over and over, but each turn of the cycle is the lifetime of one cell. And it begins when that cell is created by a previous cell splitting into two. It's just one of those two cells, okay? That cell then lives its life until such time, if it survives, if it doesn't get killed, that cell will eventually then split into two itself and create two new cells. Well, that's the end of its own cell cycle. So that's what I mean by one turn of the cell cycle being the entire lifetime of a normal cell that doesn't get killed. Most of that time during that cell cycle, if you were to look at that eukaryotic cell under the scope, you wouldn't see what we see here in this nucleus. You would see the nucleus, but it would just basically be a gray spot. You wouldn't see any detail in it. And that's because for most of the time spent in the cell cycle, the cell is not doing what it's doing here, which is preparing to split into two. I can tell just by looking at this photograph that this cell is getting ready to divide. It's starting to prepare, at least, because what's in the nucleus has changed form. Now, what do you know already is in the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell?
DNA,
which is why I said we're going to be studying DNA in one aspect or another for the rest of the term. DNA does not occur in eukaryotic cells just as DNA by itself. DNA is packaged with a bunch of proteins, and we therefore give a name to the overall mixture of DNA and those proteins. When you consider both the DNA and the proteins, that mixture is called chromatin. And chromatin is always there, even when you don't see what we're looking at here in this nucleus. The chromatin is there for the whole cell cycle. But for most of the cell cycle, when it's not yet preparing to divide into two cells, the chromatin in a eukaryotic cell is loosely arranged. It's not coiled up tightly. And therefore, that's why you see it under a light microscope as no detail, basically. It just looks like one shade of gray for the entire nucleus. When it comes time for a cell to prepare to divide, the chromatin that has been there the whole time starts to condense. It coils up much more tightly, and we're seeing that starting to happen here. Now, chromatin is the stuff, like I said, it's partly DNA, partly proteins. It's the material from which chromosomes are made. But it's kind of a word game. We don't use the word chromosome until the chromatin that makes up the chromosome coils up tightly enough so that we see it as an individual piece separate from the other chromosomes. And that hasn't happened yet here. The chromatin is starting to condense, but we can't see how many pieces there are, right? We can just tell that it's getting tighter. And therefore, we see it as bands. We don't yet know how many chromosomes are there. And therefore, the stuff of the chromosomes is there, but we don't use the word chromosomes yet. Okay. Anyway, that happens as part of the preparation for one cell to divide into two new cells, which would end its life, end its cell cycle, but create a brand new cell cycle for each of those two cells it splits into. They are various, they're part of the cytoskeleton, so not just microtubules, but yes, that chiefly they're microtubules because those are the most conspicuous of the three kinds since they're the biggest. Okay, now on to three. We see another photomicrograph here, but notice this is one chromosome. And so this would be later on in the cell cycle compared to that last slide, because the chromatin gets more and more condensed until eventually you can see individual pieces of it. And each piece is much smaller than it was when it was all a tangle. Well, this is one of those chromosomes. And how many chromosomes there are in a eukaryotic cell depends on the species. For instance, humans have 23 different kinds of chromosomes. That's a feature of our species. Some species have more than we do, like corn has 40. Some have fewer. But whatever the number of different kinds of chromosomes there are depends on species. We're looking at just one right here, though, not all of them. And this is made of chromatin, like I said, but when it's condensed to the point that you see it as an individual piece, then that's when we officially use the word chromosome. Now, this is not just a chromosome. It is a replicated chromosome, which is why it looks like it has two, well, it doesn't look like it. It does have two halves that are the same as each other. They don't just look the same in this picture. They are the same. The DNA that's part of this material is identical in the right half compared to the left half. So this is a replicated chromosome, which means it's really enough material to be two chromosomes, and it eventually will be two when these two pieces separate. But while those two halves are connected to each other still, we consider the whole thing to be one chromosome. It's also kind of a word game. All right, well, the two pieces that are genetically identical, the DNA of the two pieces are identical, those two pieces are called chromatids, which notice is very similar to the word chromatin, so don't confuse the two. D and an N are the only difference. Chromatids that are identical to each other and hooked to each other are therefore called sister chromatids. And so one replicated chromosome is made up of two identical and attached sister chromatids. And the place along the length of the chromosome at which the two sister chromatids are attached is called the centromere. Now, let's pay attention to the cartoon cells in the middle. This top one, actually, you would never see this. It's technically a lie, but they draw it this way just to make it easier to understand. Remember I said that we don't use the word chromosome until the chromatin has condensed? Well, the chromatin would not condense into this material, into a chromosome normally, for an unreplicated chromosome. What I mean by this is that by the time the chromatin starts to condense, it has already undergone replication. The DNA has already undergone replication. So let's think back to the two major functions of DNA. DNA has two major jobs, one of which is replication, the ability to copy itself exactly, and the other is transcription. Well, transcription is using the genes that are part of the DNA to make messenger RNA as part of the process of eventually producing proteins. That's the job of DNA during the lifetime of that cell, basically, within the lifetime. The other function of DNA, though, replication, is not really about the lifetime of that cell. That's part of preparing that cell to end its own life so it can split into two. If a cell is going to split into two and produce viable cells, meaning cells that are able to live, then each of those two cells that it splits into has to have not only DNA, but it has to have all of the DNA that the original cell had. Well, the only way you can accomplish that, of course, is if you first copy the DNA so you have enough for two cells before you split. And each of those two daughter cells, as they're called, will have a complete library of DNA. So that's where the replication function of DNA comes in, as a way to ensure that each cell that results from cell division has a full set of DNA. And that happens before the chromatin starts to condense into visible chromosomes. That's why you would not see this unreplicated chromosome as an actual chromosome. It would just be diffuse chromatin, and the DNA in that diffuse chromatin would replicate, so you have twice as much DNA, still diffuse, and then it would condense, and you would see once the chromosomes appeared, they would already be replicated chromosomes. Does this make sense? And that's what we're looking at here. So this is technically a lie. It would just be diffuse chromatin before DNA replication. But, like I said, the reason replication takes place is to prepare for cell division. So this cell then undergoes cell division to become two cells, each of which has unreplicated chromosome in it. Now, I guess it's not technically a lie, because this one could have been right after its parent cell split. There will be a visible chromosome for a while. But as soon as these cells are produced, their chromosomes are going to uncondense, become loose again, and not be visible as chromosomes anymore. They're just going to be chromatin. And that's because to use DNA for either of its two functions, whether it's replication or transcription, you have to be able to read the code in DNA. DNA is an informational molecule. It carries a code in the form of a sequence of nucleotides that it's made out of. If you're going to do either of these two functions, replicate the DNA or use it by reading genes as part of producing a protein, then you have to be able to get in there and read the sequence of nucleotides. And you can't do that unless the DNA is loosely arranged. When it's all condensed like this, you can't read the DNA. So, as soon as these two cells are created, the chromatin uncondenses so that the DNA then can be used for the lifetime of those cells. And when each of those cells prepares to divide, it condenses simply to keep it from being a tangled mess. The DNA is unusable during that time, but it makes it manageable so that you can then copy it, so that you can then split the cell and give each its own share. All right, let's look at a schematic in slide 4 of the cell cycle. This whole circle is one cell cycle. And how long a cell cycle lasts in time varies greatly. It just depends on the cell type. Not only on the species, but within the body of one individual like you, how long one cell cycle lasts depends greatly on the different, on the kind of cell it is. But this place where you see the two cells being created, that's more or less the start-finish line of a cell cycle. And you can see this one cell we're kind of ignoring, but it will start its own cell cycle just like this one. This cell cycle is for this particular cell. Now what you see by the band on the outside in the label is that, the labels, is that overall one cell cycle consists of two major subphases, one of which is interphase and one of which is the mitotic phase, or just the M phase. You can also see that interphase is the vast majority of the cell cycle, which is why I said earlier that you wouldn't normally see that condensing chromosome for most of the time of the cell's lifetime, which is interphase. So what I mean by these two subphases is that the combination of interphase and the mitotic phase, or M phase, makes up one cell cycle. But when you look deeper into the interior of the circle, you can see that interphase itself, which is already a subphase of the cell cycle, can be split into its own subphases. Three subphases of interphase, which are, as you see, G1, S, and G2. Now, G here stands for gap, which is kind of a misnomer because it implies nothing's really happening, but there's a lot of stuff happening in both these Gs. The reason it was named that, though, is simply because of how it looks under a microscope. When you look at a cell under G1 or G2, you don't really see much happening. And that's because the chromatin is not condensed. You don't see really anything going on that's interesting for a light microscope, but there, chemically, there's a lot going on. G1, which is the first part of interphase, you can more or less think of as the normal lifetime of that cell, whatever kind of cell it is. By which I mean, during G1, the cell is just going about its business, being whatever kind of cell it is, doing whatever that kind of cell does. And therefore, during G1, that cell is using its DNA for the purpose of transcription. The reason it has the DNA is to serve as a library where the books, instead of being books, are genes. Well, genes, as we'll see in greater detail later, are really just parts of the overall DNA sequences. Each gene is a subsequence within the overall very long sequence that we call a chromosome. But it's a good comparison to describe the DNA as a library of books, because each book is more or less a manual, a how-to manual for building an RNA molecule. That's what a cell is busy using its DNA for, transcription, during G1. When we get to the S phase, the beginning of the S phase, that cell is not yet ended its life, but When it gets to the end of G1, it has made the decision that it's time to prepare to split into two, which will end its own life and create the life of two new cells. S here stands for synthesis, the production of new DNA. So it's specifically DNA synthesis. All right, so this is what I was referring to when I, in the previous slide, when I said it was kind of a lie. When a cell reaches S, it's no longer going to have just its own share of DNA. It's going to start preparing for division, which means it needs to double its DNA, make two identical copies, or it already has one copy. It's going to make an identical copy. So by the time S is finished, that cell, even though it's still one cell, has enough DNA for two cells. And then once the DNA replication, which is what occurs in S, is finished, the cell goes into G2. In G2, it's back to using its DNA for transcription, meaning building a bunch of proteins. But in this case, it's different genes, more or less, that get read to make different kinds of proteins to do different functions. In G2, it's not so much about living its life as that kind of cell. The stuff that's happening in G2 is creating the kinds of proteins necessary to prepare for cell division. So G1, S, and G2 make up interphase, and they occur in that order. At the end of G2, you have the end of interphase and the beginning of the only other part of the overall cell cycle, which is called either the mitotic phase or the M phase. You have to be careful with this terminology too, because M stands for mitotic. And mitotic is just the adjective of mitosis. But what I mean by saying that you have to be careful is that the mitotic phase is not interchangeable with mitosis. Those two are not exactly the same thing. Mitosis is part of eukaryotic cell division. And the mitotic phase is named for the fact that the mitotic phase includes mitosis. But it includes more than just mitosis. So mitosis is not the same thing as the mitotic phase, is what I'm saying. Mitosis is a subset of the mitotic phase. The other part of the mitotic phase is the other part of eukaryotic cell division. Mitosis is just part of cell division. The other part is cytokinesis, as you see here. So let's define these two. This applies only to eukaryotic cells. So keep in mind, we're talking about eukaryotic cells, not prokaryotic cells. And eukaryotic cells, of course, have nuclei. Each one has a nucleus. So if a eukaryotic cell is about to divide into two, to make two viable cells, you need to split not only the cell overall, but you need to split the nucleus. And therefore, eukaryotic cell division has to undergo both of these processes. Mitosis is division of the nucleus. And of course, its contents, which is where the DNA is. That's where the chromatin is. Cytokinesis, on the other hand, is division of everything other than the nucleus, which is the cytoplasm collectively. Both of those have to occur in order to have two completely separate cells. But one of these processes has to be much more careful than the other. What do you suppose that is?
Which of these?
Has to be a much more careful process. Right. Because you can't just roughly give one of the two cells roughly half of the DNA and the other one whatever is left. Each of the two cells has to get exactly half, and the two halves have to be identical to each other. So each cell has to get a full library of DNA, not just approximately half of whatever DNA is there. On the other hand, when you divide the cytoplasm, which is what cytokinesis is, it doesn't have to be nearly as careful. You don't have to say, okay, this one's getting exactly this many microtubules, the other one's getting this many microtubules. It's just approximate, because if one of the cells is a little bit short of something in the cytoplasm, it can just build new stuff using the information in the nucleus that it got. So mitosis is much more careful than cytokinesis. And by the way, notice that there is no thick black line between mitosis and cytokinesis here. They just kind of blend from one shade of yellow to another. And that's to indicate the fact that these two processes overlap each other in time. In other words, cytokinesis doesn't wait until mitosis is totally done before it starts. Mitosis starts first, and then before it's totally done, cytokinesis will start. They overlap in time, and when they're both complete, then you have two officially separate cells, each of which will start its own interphase in its own cell cycle. Okay, now to five. And this will take a little bit more time than the rest of the slides, because here we can see detail that we didn't see in the previous slide. Namely, that mitosis, which is already a subphase of the mitotic phase, itself is broken into subphases. We didn't see those mitotic subphases in the previous slide. But mitosis consists of five major subphases, which are listed here: prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. And then, of course, we also have cytokinesis. But mitosis is just division of the nucleus, and those five subphases I just mentioned are parts of just mitosis. Overall in this slide, though, we see a little bit more than just mitosis. And we can see a real photomicrograph that's been colorized at the top of each one, but the cartoon one is really better to look at in order to understand what's happening in each of these things. Well, the first column here is G2 of interphase. So this is not yet in the mitotic phase. It's not yet in mitosis. This is still in G2 of interphase. But the reason it's shown here is so that we can compare what's happening in G2 compared to what's happening in the first subphase of mitosis. So let's look at that first, G2 of interphase. Keep in mind where G2 is. It's after S. So this cell has already been through S, which is when DNA replication occurs. All right? Well, in DNA replication, of course, it's the DNA that gets doubled, gets replicated, but also centrosomes get replicated in interphase. Think back to what centrosomes are. We talked about centrosomes as being microtubule organizing centers when we looked at the tour of the cell. And I showed you just in the cartoon that I showed you at the time, there was just one centrosome. That's what a cell starts out with. But in interphase, as part of interphase, the centrosome gets replicated also, not just the DNA that's in the nucleus. Centrosomes are outside of the DNA here, but now there's already two of them because this thing has been through interphase. It's just getting to the mitotic phase, starting mitosis. And we can tell that this is an animal cell, by the way, because remember I told you that the centrosome of an animal cell contains these T-shaped proteins called centrioles that we don't really know what they do, but they're in animal cells. They're not in other kinds of centrosomes for other species. Anyway, there's two of them in G2, and they're more or less right next to each other. It's two centrosomes. If we look at the nucleus, we can see, well, you probably don't see it from where you are. You kind of see strands. So that's chromatin, but it's chromatin that is just starting to condense, which is why we see any detail at all. Otherwise, it would just be a solid blue background in the nucleus. Okay, so the chromatin has just started to condense. We don't really see anything individually yet. Now, let's compare that to the very first subphase of mitosis, which is prophase. In prophase, there's a couple things important that are happening. One is that the two centrosomes are polarizing. They're becoming polarized, which has nothing to do with charge. Polarized simply means they're going to opposite poles, opposite ends of the cells. And they're doing, I mean, the reason they're moving away from each other is because of the fact that each centrosome, being a microtubule organizing center, which centrosomes are, is growing microtubules from that centrosome. You can see that these yellow strands are microtubules growing out from each centrosome. And those microtubules are interacting with each other, pushing on each other, and therefore causing these two centrosomes that are right next to each other to start going to opposite ends of the cells. They haven't become fully polarized yet. And we therefore see what's labeled as the early mitotic spindle. A mitotic spindle is named for the fact that it's important in mitosis. A spindle is something that is thicker in the middle, wider in the middle, and tapered at the ends. And in other words, kind of football shaped. We can see that starting to form here. The mitotic spindle consists of two centrosomes and the microtubules that are growing from those centrosomes. That's what's occurring out in the cytoplasm. Now let's look at the nucleus in prophase. For one thing, the nuclear envelope, which is the boundary of the nucleus, is still intact here in prophase. So there are two clearly defined compartments, nucleoplasm and cytoplasm, still. But if you look inside the nucleus, we can see that the chromatin that's in that nucleus has undergone much more condensing compared to G2 of interphase. So we're starting to see chromosomes, but it hasn't condensed yet to the point of us being able to tell how many chromosomes there are yet, because they're not as condensed or small as they're going to be yet. So that's what happens in prophase. Condensing of the chromatin, polarization of the centrosomes to create the mitotic spindle. Next is prometaphase. And so if we look at the cartoon here, we can see that the mitotic spindle is much more developed at this point. The two centrosomes of the mitotic spindle are completely polarized at this point. They're at totally opposite ends of the cell. The nucleus has undergone a profound change. Remember I said that in prophase earlier, the nuclear envelope was still intact. In prometaphase, the nuclear envelope has been disintegrated. Now, the reason that the nuclear envelope disintegrates is that the chromosomes, which are in the nucleus, and the mitotic spindle, which is outside the nucleus, have to interact. And to do that, I mean, and the nucleus, the nuclear envelope, if it's there, would be in the way of that interaction. It would, right? You have to have something in the cytoplasm meet up with something in the nucleoplasm. Therefore, you need to get rid of that boundary, which is the nuclear envelope. So in prometaphase, the nuclear envelope disintegrates. In what was the nucleus, and technically it's not a nucleus anymore because you don't have a nuclear envelope, but what the stuff that was in the nucleus, which is the chromatin, has undergone much more condensing. And so by now, you can see individual chromosomes, and that's when we technically would be justified in using the word chromosomes. It's not because it's different stuff. It's just much more compact. And we can tell apart each chromosome from the others. Notice, by the way, that each chromosome is not only separate from the other chromosomes, but each one is replicated. Each one has two sister chromatids connected at a centromere, like we looked at in that slide 2. And this makes sense because, remember, this cell has already been through S. S of interphase is when DNA replication occurs. That's when there's suddenly twice as much DNA as one cell needs. And that's why the chromosomes appear, they're already replicated. Okay, now back to this idea of interaction between the mitotic spindle and the chromosomes. You can't see it in this, probably from where you are on this slide, but you'll see a better close-up later. You might just barely be able to make out that each chromosome features two little black dots right at the centromere, which is where the two sister chromatids are held together. Each of those black dots is called a kinetochore. Kinetochore. Okay, so one replicated chromosome has two kinetochores, one for each of its two sister chromatids that make up the overall replicated chromosome. A kinetochore is an attachment site for a microtubule. Now, the microtubules are in yellow in this cartoon. And they're the same kinds of stuff, they're the same material as the microtubules that make up the cytoskeleton. We already talked about those little roadways that motor proteins walk along. But for the mitotic spindle, these microtubules are serving a specialized purpose. They're there for the purpose of mitosis. And the mitotic spindle, like I said, is both centrosomes and all of the microtubules that are springing from it. But even though, chemically speaking, molecularly speaking, all of these microtubules of the spindle are the same stuff, there's two categories of microtubules in the spindle. One of those categories of microtubules is kinetochore microtubules. And those get their name because those particular microtubules of the spindle are the ones that actually connect to the kinetochores on the replicated chromosomes. And in order for that connection to be made, you have to get rid of the boundary between the nucleus and the cytoplasm. That's why the nuclear envelope disintegrates. Let's look at how this connection is made, though. I don't know whether you can make it out, but each replicated chromosome, like I said, has two kinetochores. Well, one kinetochore will be connected to a kinetochore microtubule that springs from one centrosome, one pole, and the other kinetochore on that same replicated chromosome connects to a kinetochore microtubule springing from the other centrosome, the other pole. And that happens for as many chromosomes as there are for the species. The other category of microtubules can go by either of two names. You can either call them non-kinetic or microtubules, which makes sense, because they don't connect to kinetochores. Or you can call them polar microtubules. This book calls them non-kinetic or microtubules. The non-kinetic or microtubules do not make connections to kinetochores, like I said, but they're still important. They're the ones that interact with each other. The non-kinetic or microtubules from one centrosome interact with non-kinetic or microtubules from the other centrosome to not only polarize the two centrosomes originally, but once they've gotten on to opposite ends, continued interactions between non-kinetic or microtubules will keep pushing them apart, so it will start elongating the cell, which is an important part of eventually dividing. All right. So those are the two categories of microtubules. The important thing in prometaphase is that their connections are made between kinetic or microtubules and the chromosomes themselves. But it's just the connection. The chromosomes are just wherever. No special position, but they've been connected to by these kinetochores. Now we go to the next phase, which is metaphase. And metaphase is the shortest of the phases in terms of time, because metaphase is only a brief period in which all of the replicated chromosomes, however many there are, which, like I said, depends on species, occur or are placed halfway between the two poles. Now, to be placed halfway between the two poles means that the replicated chromosomes need to move to that middle. And they're only able to do that if they first dock to the kinetochore microtubules in the previous phase. Okay, so the reason that they're able to be brought halfway between the two poles is because the kinetochore microtubules are connected to them. That position, now it looks in this cartoon like they're lined up in a single line. Really, they don't have to be in a line, they have to be in a plane, because this is really three-dimensional, right? And so think of a globe. If you cut the globe through the equator, you don't do it with a line, you do it with a plane. And anything in that plane is halfway between the North and South Pole. That plane that goes halfway through that cuts the cell in half between the two poles is called the equatorial plate. And that's the position of the replicated chromosomes during the phase we call metaphase. Another thing about metaphase is that the condensing of chromatin reaches its maximum at metaphase. So the chromosomes here, it's not so obvious, but they're even a little bit smaller than they were in prometaphase. Chromosomes are never smaller than they are at metaphase, and therefore they're easiest during metaphase to tell apart from each other. All right, next is anaphase. Now, keep in mind, the overall thing we're studying here is mitosis, which is division of the nucleus, but there hasn't been anything dividing yet until we get to anaphase. Anaphase is the subphase of mitosis in which we finally have things separating. And look at what we have separating in the cartoon version. What separate and move apart from each other are the two sister chromatids that used to be connected at a centromere to make up one replicated chromosome. All right, so this is one sister chromatid, this is the other sister chromatid, except, and this is another word game we play, once the two sister chromatids are separated from each other, we no longer call them chromatids. Now that they're separated, each former chromatid is now a chromosome in its own right. But it's an unreplicated chromosome because it has DNA enough for just one cell. And the other former sister chromatid is now also an identical unreplicated chromosome, but it's going to end up in a different cell. There's going to be two cells eventually. Okay, this is how each daughter cell, as the two are called, will have an identical full set of DNA because each one gets one unreplicated chromosome from each of the different kinds of replicated chromosomes. Okay? So they start moving toward the daughter chromosomes, the unreplicated daughter chromosomes. And daughter here doesn't have anything to do with sex of the cell. It's just a word we use. These daughter chromosomes, as they're called, start moving toward one pole or the other, depending on which one they're, depending on which kinetic or microtubule they're connected to. That's anaphase. The final subphase of mitosis is telophase, and telo means far, like in telescope. The reason it's called telophase is because these daughter chromosomes that separated from each other and started moving away from each other in anaphase get as far apart as possible. In other words, they reach the poles that they're approaching in anaphase. Each set of daughter chromosomes reaches one pole, which is a centrosome. Each pole, by the way, each centrosome is associated with one of the two cells that are about to exist. At the moment, we still have one cell, technically, but it's about to split into two. And each one has one of those centrosomes. Okay? So in telophase, these chromosomes reach their pole, and each pole forms its own nucleus. So the nuclear envelope had already disintegrated, like we said back in prometaphase. In prometaphase. Well, now a brand new nuclear envelope forms around this collection of one collection of daughter chromosomes, and at the other pole, another nucleus forms, enclosing the other identical set of daughter chromosomes. And at that point, what we have here is technically one cell with two nuclei. But that doesn't last very long, because even though mitosis is over, division of the nucleus, overall cell division is not yet over because we haven't divided the rest, the other compartment, the cytoplasm. Well, telophase is not shown here in isolation. It's shown in one picture along with cytokinesis, even though they're separate processes because of what I was telling you about the yellow shading. Cytokinesis and telophase, the end of mitosis, overlap each other in time. So while these two new nuclei are forming, which is part of telophase, you also have cytokinesis starting. And cytokinesis, remember, is the division of the cytoplasm. This is an animal cell. And the way cytokinesis happens in an animal cell is that a cleavage furrow, as it's called, starts forming at the position of the equatorial plate, halfway between the two poles. And that a furrow is just a ditch. So when you look at the side view, it looks like a ditch is being dug. It gets deeper and deeper until eventually, not shown here, the two pieces totally become separate from each other. And that's when you officially have two brand new cells, each of which is now in the very beginning of interphase of its own cell cycle. And it will go around again for each of these two cells. Okay, that was a quick, well, not so quick, summary of eukaryotic cell division, mitosis and cytokinesis. Now let's let's look at some details in with some bigger shots. Slide 6 is a much better view of metaphase than we saw before. For one thing, because of the way it's drawn in perspective, you can see this fact that they don't have to be lined up. They just have to all be within the equatorial plate, which looks like it's a piece of glass. It's actually not a structure. The metaphase plate is just an imaginary plane halfway between the two poles. You also, though, get a much better view of the fact that each replicated chromosome consisting of two identical sister chromatids features two kinetochores, one kinetochore per chromatid. And those kinetochores are connection points between the chromatid itself and the kinetochore microtubules from one centrosome. The other kinetochore for the other sister chromatid is going to be connected with kinetochore microtubules from the other pole. That happened in the previous phase, by the way, the connection, right? That happens in prometaphase. But once the connection is made, then these replicated chromosomes can be moved to the halfway point, which is the equatorial plate. We'll look at how that happens in a minute. Well, actually, right now. Slide 7. There could be any number of hypotheses to explain how chromosomes reach the metaphase plate in metaphase, halfway between the poles. But this figure is about trying to determine which of two major hypotheses is correct. If you think about moving chromosomes that are already connected to kinetochore microtubules, there's two major ways that makes sense could happen. One is more or less like fishing, where the kinetochore microtubule is like fishing line. In other words, you hook, like hooking a fish, you hook a chromosome at the kinetochore when you make the connection, and then if you reel it in at the other end, which is the centrosome, then you're going to drag the chromosome along because you've hooked it. So that's one possibility. Another, though, is that the kinetochore microtubules serve as little roads along which chromosomes can move once they have the connection made. All right? They both make sense, but in science it's important to give evidence at supporting one or the other. So, in this experiment, what they did is use a chemical technique that marked the spindle, the microtubules of the spindle, which is more or less like taking a felt marker and making this black band. That's not what they did, of course, but think of it that way. Okay, so you make this mark. Now, if the rod and reel, the fishing hypothesis, is correct, then you would expect the microtubules to be reeled in toward the centrosome, which means just like if you mark fishing line, that mark should get closer and closer to the reel, which is the centrosome itself. Well, that didn't happen. If, on the other hand, the other major hypothesis, that the microtubules are serving as roads, is true, then the mark should stay in place, right, as part of the road, and the chromosomes should move closer to the mark and eventually pass the mark. You following me on that? And that's what actually happens. You can see that in the results picture. And the conclusion picture on the bottom shows you how it happens. So you're already familiar with the fact that microtubules that are part of the cytoskeleton serve as roadways along which motor proteins can walk, and those motor proteins carry some sort of cargo, like a vesicle we talked about before. Same thing's happening here. When you look at the molecular detail of a kinetochore, which is this teal round thing, you can see that a kinetochore contains a motor protein. And when the connection between a kinetochore microtubule and the kinetochore itself is made, you're putting that motor protein on a road along which it can walk. But in this case, this is kind of a special road. Most roads are built to be used over and over again. Well, for the roads that are part of mitosis, that are part of the mitotic spindle, they only need to be used one time. Right? There's only one time this road is going to be used. And so what happens, and this is why it kind of looks like the thing is being reeled in. What really happens, though, is as soon as the motor proteins walk along a certain part of the road, the road behind it, which is no longer ever going to be used again, starts being dismantled into little chunks that it's made out of and then recycled as material. That's why it looks like the microtubules are being reeled in, because they're getting shorter, but not because they're getting reeled in, but because they're being disintegrated behind the motor protein as it walks along. That's correct now these days, right? Okay. Yeah. All right, let's go to 8. In 8, we have a little bit more detail of what's on the left of what's happening in cytokinesis for an animal cell. Remember the slide where I showed you all of mitosis, that was for an animal cell. Well, in other eukaryotes, mitosis is pretty much the same, including plants. But cytokinesis is not the same in animal and plant cells. And that's because of the difference that we've talked about before between an animal and plant cells in terms of their boundary. All cells have a plasma membrane, including animal cells. But an animal cell has a plasma membrane and that's it. Whereas a plant cell has a plasma membrane and then exterior to that, a much thicker and more sturdy cell wall, right? Well, this is why a flimsy animal cell can undergo cytokinesis by more or less a drawstring mechanism. This cleavage furrow that I was talking about that forms, it's not just an analogy with a drawstring, it really is a drawstring. If you think of a belt for pants, you know, we usually wear that belt on the outside of the pants. But a cell has a belt made out of microfilaments, a loop of microfilament making a belt that actually goes through protein complexes forming belt loops, but they're inside surface of the cell. And as that circle of microfilament starts overlapping with itself more and more, it cinches it up. It makes it a tighter and tighter belt, and that's what draws in the two edges of the plasma membrane toward each other to form the cleavage furrow. And it gets more and more drastic until it actually pinches off and you have two fully separate, genetically identical cells at that point for an animal cell. Well, a plant cell can't do that because of the sturdy cell wall. So it happens a little bit differently. Like I said, mitosis is the same, and that has already happened. So we already have two genetically identical nuclei in this plant cell. But we're not going to cinch it off with a belt in a plant. Instead, at the metaphase plate, and notice that in this picture, the metaphase plate is vertical, but it's still halfway between the poles, right? It's just, we're looking at it 90 degrees different. Anyway, at that metaphase plate, as part of cytokinesis, we have the formation of vesicles, little bags made out of membrane, right? And the contents of those vesicles is the material from which cell walls are made. Okay, so this is cell wall material wrapped in membrane material, each one. And there's many of them that form along the metaphase plate. They get bigger and bigger as they accumulate more and more sell wall material. And therefore, as they grow, they approach each other, right? The edges of each other approach, and eventually they will touch each other. And since they're both made out of membrane material, the sac part at least, that membrane material will coalesce, just like a vesicle inside a cell reaching the plasma membrane will coalesce and become part of the plasma membrane, right? And so instead of having individual vesicles at that point, we now have what's called a cell plate, which is made of cell wall material inside, but it's completely surrounded by membrane material. Well, it continues to grow until the two ends kiss the two edges of the plasma membrane in this cell. This is the plasma membrane. And when that happens, look what we have. This part, this half of the former cell plate is now the inside part of the plasma membrane of this individual cell, and this one is the other cell. And in between those two cells is cell wall. Okay, so that's how cytokinesis in a plant happens. Slide 9 shows you pictures of mitosis happening in a plant cell, but like I just told you, there isn't really any major difference between how mitosis happens in an animal compared to a plant. So I'm not going to go through this again. I already did. It just shows you photographic evidence that plant cells undergo the same steps of mitosis as animal cells. Slide 10. Well, it doesn't make sense to talk about mitosis in a prokaryote, because mitosis is division of nucleus, and a prokaryotic cell doesn't have a nucleus. So it is true that no prokaryotic cell undergoes mitosis, but even prokaryotic cells, of course, undergo cell division. It's just not called a combination of mitosis and cytokinesis. It's called binary fission. Binary meaning into two, and fission means splitting. It's accomplishing the same thing, so that two cells can be created out of one. And just like a eukaryotic cell has to prepare for cell division by first replicating its genome, which is the combination of all the DNA in the cell, that has to be done in a prokaryotic cell as well. You can't split into two unless you first replicate your DNA. And so that happens, but there's a couple differences in a prokaryotic cell. One, of course, is that the DNA is not in a nucleus in a prokaryote. Another, though, has to do with the chromosome itself. A eukaryotic cell has some number of chromosomes. Like I said, that depends on the species, but it's generally more than one chromosome. And however many there are, each eukaryotic chromosome is linear, which means there are two ends. On the other hand, a typical prokaryotic cell has just one chromosome, and it is a circular chromosome, so there aren't any ends. It wraps back on itself into a loop. Well, you can't really see that it's a loop in this figure. It looks like a tangled mess, but it's actually not a tangled mess. It starts out, this is all one loop. This is before DNA replication. So you could spread it out and form a circle, but it's all one loop. It prepares for binary fission by first undergoing DNA replication. So now here, there's twice as much material. There are two loops, two identical circular chromosomes. And then cell splitting can happen, binary fission can happen, which is a little bit simpler because you don't have this complication of having an extra chamber. You just have to make sure that each of the two cells gets one of the two replicated chromosomes. That's binary fission. Slide 11 is back to eukaryotic cells. So this is mitosis featured in all of these A through D. Well, actually, I'm sorry. A is binary fission, just to compare it. B, C, and D are all eukaryotic mitosis. But this shows you that how mitosis happens actually isn't identical in all eukaryotes. Animals and plants have basically the same method, but some eukaryotes, dinoflagellates that you see here, do not disintegrate their nuclear envelope. Remember I said that you have to do that in order to make a connection between the kinetochore microtubules and the chromosomes? Well, dinoflagellates get away from that problem by having holes in their nuclear envelope through which the microtubules can pass, so they don't have to disintegrate the whole nuclear envelope. And other kinds of eukaryotes, diatoms and yeasts among them, get away from that problem. They also don't have to disintegrate their nuclear envelope because the mitotic spindle actually forms inside the nucleus, so there is no need to disintegrate it. But most eukaryotes, including animals and plants, do it the way I've already described, by disintegrating. Okay, 12. Now that we've studied the particulars of cell division and the cell cycle in general, it's time to talk about how a cell determines whether it should go from one subphase to the next. In other words, how is the cell cycle for any given kind of cell controlled? It's reasonable to think that there must be a control, but you can't just say this is reasonable, therefore it's true in science. You have to demonstrate it. And it's also reasonable to guess that however the cell cycle is controlled, it probably involves some sort of chemical signal to make things happen the way they do. But once again, you have to demonstrate that. So, in this experiment, what they did was take two cells of the same kind, from the same species, but just in different parts of their own cell cycle. They took an S phase and a G1 phase. Now remember, G1 is before S. So this G1 cell is earlier in its cell cycle than this one is. And they fused them, so they combined them into one cell. And what they noticed is as soon as they did that, the part of this double cell, more or less, that was in G1 immediately started replicating its DNA, immediately went into the S phase. And so this supports the hypothesis that there is a chemical or a material involved in telling the cell it's time to go on, right? Because it's been exposed to it, and now it's responding. But much better evidence is shown in the experiment 2, in which they took an M phase. This is a cell that's already in cell division, and fused it with a G1. Now G1 is as far from the M phase as possible, right? It just started its own cell cycle. It hasn't gone through S or G2, let alone M phase. But when you fuse the two, this former G1 part immediately starts trying to divide, even though it can't possibly be successful because it hasn't even yet replicated its chromosome. It doesn't have two things to divide. But it tries to anyway. And so this is much better evidence that some chemical signal that it's been exposed to by fusing it with this other cell must be part of the control of the cell cycle. And we'll look at how that can happen next time.